Today, has the RBA lost its way? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, working on the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, the RBA cut the cash rate for a second time in a row, and this signals the ongoing concerns they have regarding the state of the economy. Those following DFA will know that we've become increasingly concerned about the weak numbers and the desperate attempt to try to use household debt as a prop once again. But Westpac made the point that whereas the average response to first moves is a clear positive, with sentiment increasing on average by 5.6 percentage points, the response to follow-on cuts is often negative, with an average decline of 3.5 percentage points. The latter reflects a mix of cooling off from an initial sentiment boost and other developments. It might be interpreted as panic, we'll see. And on top of that, the banker's banker, the Bank for International Settlements, or BIS, came out overnight with its annual report, which included a section entitled Time to Ignite All Engines. In summary, they said that monetary policy can no longer be the main engine of economic growth, and other policy drivers need to kick in to ensure the global economy achieves sustainable momentum. They call for a better balance between monetary policy, structural reforms, fiscal policy, and macroprudential measures. This would allow the global economy to move away from the debt-fueled growth model that risks turbulence ahead. Navigating the way to clearer skies means balancing speed with stability and conserving some fuel to cope with possible headwinds, says BIS General Manager Augustin Kasters. A sustainable flight path requires the long overdue full engagement of all four engines of policy, rather than short-term turbocharges. In the report, the BIS says that although global expansion hit a soft patch last year, the resilience of service industries and strong labour markets can support growth in the near term. Employment increases and solid wage rises have sustained consumption still. Significant risks remain, including trade tensions and rising debt, particularly in the corporate sector of some economies. As well as clouding future demand and investment prospects, the trade tensions raise questions about the viability of existing supply chain structures and about the very future of the global trading system, says Karsten. Trade wars have no winners. Other risks to the outlook include weak bank profits in several advanced economies and deleveraging in some major emerging markets, or EMES, particularly China. Necessary moves to curb credit growth there act as a drag on activity, they said. EMES' great sensitivity to global financial conditions and resulting capital flows has meant that since the financial crisis, they have had to cope with strong spillovers from accommodative monetary policies in advanced economies. And one chapter of their report analyzes how EME monetary policy frameworks have sought to tackle the resulting trade-offs. The frameworks typically combine inflation targeting with currency intervention and are complemented with macroprudential measures to address the build-up of financial vulnerabilities. This kind of multiple-tool policy making is not yet very well anchored conceptually. EME monetary policy practice has moved ahead of theory. Theory has to catch up, says Claudia Borro, head of the Monetary and Economic Department. So, central bankers are warned. We have hit the buffers in terms of monetary policy. We cannot solely focus on the short-term impact of their rate decisions on narrow parts of the economy. So now, let's remind ourselves that the RBA has the mandate to maintain price stability, full employment, and the economic prosperity and welfare of the Australian people. So, how are they doing? Not good, in my view, on the prosperity and welfare front, I suggest. So let's look at some of the broad assumptions underlying monetary policy. And a shout out to a recent LiveWire article linked below, which helped to crystallise my thoughts. The first is the need for inflation above 2%. While some suggest that low inflation expectations would cause consumers to delay purchasing goods and services, I wonder if you would really delay just because it was going to be, say, 1% cheaper in a year's time. That is hardly meaningful. Second, we need to learn from Japan, where their low GDP and inflation growth stemmed from poor investment decisions in the 1980s, an aging and declining population, a failure to implement productivity reforms, and the failure to clear banks of their bad debts. Now, Europe seems to be going the same way. Japan should serve as an example of not what to do and what doesn't work, rather than example of the need to pursue even more aggressive monetary and fiscal stimulus. Then there is the Phillips curve, which is a bit of central bank religion despite the fact that it is broken. Low inflation and low unemployment are decoupled, period. And generally we see central bankers tweaking their models, but they're missing the obvious impact of credit and asset bubbles. This is because they still think credit growth is unimportant, when in fact it's central. The RBA's recent outing on this was, well, frankly, embarrassing. The point is, low interest rates will create credit and asset price bubbles. This is because buyers of property will compare the yield it generates to other potential investment sectors, particularly, for example, bonds. The RBA only recently embraced this point. Low rates impact everything. Savers are caught, and each additional rate cut forces another wave of selling of safe assets to purchase riskier assets. Many of these will be debt-related. For example, residential investment properties are typically geared, but so are listed and unlisted property trusts. And those seeking buying bank preference shares or hybrids are taking on substantial embedded leverage, with around 92% of bank liabilities ranking senior to their position. This additional leverage just makes our financial system systemically more unstable, and this is in absolute opposite to the RBA's mandate of enhancing the stability of the financial system. Now, recently the governor said that households pay around $2 of interest for each dollar of interest they receive. Given that interest rates for home loans, car loans, personal loans and credit cards are far higher than deposit rates, this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. In fact, there are as many people holding savings as loans, so a rate cut is effectively redistributing from depositors to borrowers. And by repeatedly cutting rates, the RBA has strongly incentivized households to switch from being savers to borrowers, primarily through the residential property market, supported by banks borrowing from overseas. You know, we keep underlining that household debt levels and property prices have surged since 2011, at a time when the Reserve Bank cut a massive 3.5% off the cash rate. Had rates been kept at more sensible levels, Australian banks could have sourced more of their funding from safe Australian depositors, and they would be far less reliant on the fast money of international bondholders and the liquidity risks this represents. And by the way, the marginal rate cuts do not have a massive impact on most borrowers. Sure, interest-only borrowers receive a benefit, but most borrowers are making principal and interest repayments, so their 25-year loan will be repaid maybe 1 year earlier, meaning that the impact of rate cuts for borrowers is predominantly back-ended, resulting in little short-term stimulus for the economy. But low rates mean people can borrow more on new loans, and APRA, of course, has removed the 7% serviceability test, meaning that every rate cut increases the amount that an applicant may be able to borrow. This means property prices can go higher still. But get this, rate cuts largely caused the explosion in household debt, and yet, now the RBA points to the high household debt as a reason it can't raise rates back to a neutral level. If we tried to unwind the excessive monetary stimulus, a recession would surely follow. And rate cuts have a more immediate impact on savers, many of whom are older and who have de-risked their portfolios as they no longer earn material income from work. The rates on term deposit bonds and other low-risk assets have crashed, reducing a large part of their income. Many choose just to spend less rather than increasing their investment risk or living off their capital, according to our surveys. And those saving to buy a house or to build super for retirement have seen returns crash too. Many of these will choose to throttle back their spending for the desired future lifestyle. So, tell me again where consumption growth is going to come from? And in the commercial sector, low rates do not necessarily translate into more business investment. Businesses will invest when business demand is there, when they might buy more equipment or even hire more staff. But we see the rise of so-called zombie companies who take up space that should be left open for new businesses offering better and cheaper products. Japan and Europe are textbook examples. Their lower interest rates, barriers to entry, and government bailouts have allowed poorly capitalized and poorly managed businesses to stagger on. Plus, they borrow at low rates to buy back shares, artificially inflating their value to no good benefit. Firms in the USA are up to their eyes in unproductive debt. And turning to construction, the Reserve Bank says lower interest rates will stimulate housing construction in the short term, as some builders and buyers will be willing to speculate on future house price growth as rates fall. But the RBA has failed to recognise that ultimately the amount of housing required reflects population growth, and we have more than 1 million vacant properties in Australia today, and having such excessive stocks of empty houses will eventually result in a collapse in house prices. Just look at the US, Ireland and Spain prior to the financial crisis. Add to collapsing house prices, increasing unemployment and high levels of household debt, and we get a recession, which is still, by the way, one of my main scenarios. The RBA says a cut will push down the Australian dollar, helping both exporters and service industries like education and tourism. But the main cost of a lower Australian dollar is a higher cost of imported goods. This comprises a substantial portion of goods consumed, as we have a narrow and diminishing manufacturing base. And this will dampen consumption, as imported goods will cost more and add to the cost of producing goods and services, reducing export competitiveness. These offsets are barely considered. Perhaps rate cuts will boost employment in the short term, but down the track, this impact will be lost as construction reverts to normal levels and the impact on the Australian dollar fades. Long term, the impact of rate cuts on employment is decidedly negative. And rate cuts well beyond normal levels increase financial instability, creating the risks of a 1990 type level of recession. Such a rapid reduction in demand across businesses and consumers would see unemployment soar. And by cutting rates too far, the RBA has created the conditions for it to badly fail on its full employment and economic prosperity aims in the future. So in fact, monetary policy is now part of the problem and not the answer. Further cuts in interest rates will exhaust the firepower that might be useful if a recession begins, as well as increasing the likelihood of recession brought on by excessive debt and speculative investment. Had interest rates been left at their 2011 levels, house prices and household debt levels would be far lower today, and the Australian financial system would be on a much firmer footing. Governor Lowe's recent speech called on government to increase fiscal stimulus, particularly infrastructure spending. But the projects must be the right ones and run efficiently. In fact, most fiscal stimulus is merely a short-term measure akin to a sugar hit that quickly fades. Of course, population growth has been the secret source of the Australian economy for years, but this covers up the fact that Australia is currently in a per capita recession and had another per capita recession back in 2008. There are consequences for our abnormally high population growth. It reduces the quality of life for existing residents. It is also enormously expensive, particularly for state governments that need to spend tens of billions of dollars on the infrastructure required to meet the additional demand. A much smaller migration intake, targeted at increasing the wealth and skill set of Australia, would be a net positive, but the current number and the segmentation of migrants is not the answer. At the end of Philip Lowe's speech, he said productivity growth will be the main source of improvement in our living standards. But so far, we've made little progress here. The tax system does not support it. Innovation is not valued, and we grasp for easy fixes and low interest rates. Tax reform and productivity improvements are the critical ingredients, but they are missing in action at the moment. RBA, it's time for a reset. We need to shun short-term monetary and fiscal stimulus and move to strategy reform. That is what the real role of government and the RBA should be. Then, and only then, will the RBA meet its objectives. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.